So for those who, some of you asked if we met yesterday, last week, not yesterday, but last week. Anne, did you say you were in D.C.?
Yes, we were.
You went up for the snow.
They said it was going to snow. They didn't say it was a blizzard.
Well, congratulations. We have a little here, but yes, we met. We had a group here, and we did two psalms, and I wish I could remember which ones they were. We did 24 and 136. So we started out doing Psalm 1 and 2, the kind of prologue psalms, one of which is a wisdom psalm and one which is a messianic or royal psalm. And then Psalm 24 is a liturgical song, a psalm, and Psalm 136 is a historical / liturgical psalm. And we're going to today look at psalms that would fall roughly into the category of lament, complaint, and supplication. So, psalms of prayer, which will cover six or so of nine or so categories, depending on how you put all that together. I've begun each week by reminding us of Nahum Sarna's bit of wisdom about the Psalter, that last statement especially, that these are essentially a record of the human quest for God. And you'll remember the notion in Jewish tradition that the Psalter has five books in it that are reminiscent of the five books of the law, the Torah, the original part of the Hebrew Scriptures. And in that sense, the notion is in Hebrew tradition that in the Torah, God reveals himself to humans, and in the Psalter, humans are speaking back to God, revealing themselves to God. And there's just a basic list of the kinds of categories of psalms or genres of psalms that you might see. You'll see different lists of these, different numbers, different names, but that's a pretty good representative list, and they function devotionally, formationally, and liturgically, and some of them in all ways. And we use them in our liturgy because every Sunday we have a psalm, don't we? And today, I think this is going to look familiar to you. This is one of the, this is the text from today. So let's do as we've done. Let's read this together and then we'll reflect on it a bit. In you, O Lord, have I taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed. In your righteousness, deliver me and set me free. Incline your ear to me and save me. Be my strong rock, a castle to keep me safe. You are my crag and my stronghold. Deliver me, my God, from the hand of the wicked, from the clutches of the evildoer and the oppressor. For you are my hope, O Lord God, my confidence since I was young. I have been sustained by you ever since I was born. From my mother's womb you have been my strength. My praise shall always be of you. Shall be always of you, yeah. let's just note again what happens in this psalm. What is the speaker saying to God?
He's looking for deliverance, isn't he?
It appears so. Yeah, deliver me from the hand of the wicked and from the oppressor. You'll also see in this a feature we mentioned of this poetry, this parallelism, that deliver me, my God, from the hand of the wicked, from the clutches of the evildoer and the oppressor. Sometimes these lines will repeat something with different language to say the same thing. Sometimes they'll take you off in the opposite direction. This is an instance of the parallelism where we have the same idea being stated with different terms. So deliver from the hand of the wicked is expressed really more viscerally by saying from the clutches of the evildoer and the oppressor. It's you're being held onto, you can't get away. And the prayer is for deliverance from. And someone said sustain. Yeah, there doesn't have to. There's not just one idea. There's usually multiple ideas.
What, David? What is the myth ashamed? Is that from what I've done, or what is it? What is that getting to?
The notion of we could psychologize ourselves about what we think about that, but in these texts, shame and reproach signals something related to the covenant of God. Remember the notion we talked about, the covenant term kesed, that we saw it in Psalm 136, which is a history of Israel retold in about 20 some odd verses of poetry with a refrain that his kesed endures forever. We translated mercy or loving kindness or steadfast love. And that term is a term related to God's covenant loyalty, that God made a promise that God will always keep. But in that covenant, of course, there's some conditions placed on the people, right? There's some if-thens related to the blessing given to Abraham of land and people and the kind of happiness of God that comes from following Yahweh. And the notion of shame and reproach shows up in the prophets and in these poetic texts as Israel lamenting that they have not been faithful to God and therefore they don't have the blessing that was promised to them. And the ultimate instance of this is them being taken away from Jerusalem, the temple being destroyed, and them being sent into exile. And that there's where you have these statements about reproach and shame. And you will also see it put on the lips of King David when he is running from his enemies, when his throne is being threatened, and he can't be on his throne. He's instead running in the wilderness. And the question is there, God, will you let me suffer reproach? Will you not do what you have said that you will do? Shame and reproach is directly tied to that notion of covenant. That doesn't mean that it doesn't imply guilt on the part of people who've done something wrong or anything like that, but I'm saying it's actually bigger than that. There's a kind of national sentiment there about the people not being in the place of divine blessing. And I'd start to say, because they haven't done something, but they're always asking the question, oh Lord, how long? You hear that in the psalm text, as if God's just not coming through and they're wondering when God will. Yeah, there's that sentiment to it. I don't want to polish up the poetry too much because it has this sense of disappointment that things have turned out like they have. Yeah, Frank, and then we'll come to Charles.
It seems funny that it follows that I have taken refuge. Almost like a shame because of the way that sentence is structured. To me, it reads almost like the shame is somehow referring to the refuge.
Yeah, I think it's that in you I've taken refuge, and you are a strong rock, a castle to keep me safe, my crag and stronghold, so don't let anything befall me that would be shameful. But it's written out of a context where they have been ashamed. They have suffered reproach because things have not always turned out as they would wish. It's almost like a how could this be? The Psalter leaves you sometimes with this uneasiness about things. I know we have some of the texts that are just beautifully comforting, the Lord is my shepherd, right? And leave you with repose. And then there are some of these that are quite unsettling. Not only the ones that are about our own reproach, but also the ones about smite the enemy and crush their heads. And we had some of that last week, remember? Yeah. And we're a little uncomfortable with it. In fact, in the lectionary, you'll find on some Sundays, those are just excised. In fact, when we look at our next psalm, there's a section of that psalm that in the Book of Common Prayer in the lectionary, it's dropped out. So we'll think about what to do with that. Charles?
I just wanted to say that in the ancient world, including, of course, the Hebrews, you really can't separate the personal pronoun from the communal. And even though you see I, there is in the deep background, I think, this idea of identification with the community, with the people. that's something that gets lost as time progresses and we become individualists. And I only refer to some individuals.
And no doubt in these texts, this is true. These are the prayers of the people. That's why we called this little class this. It is Israel's. It's the prayers and songs of the people of God. And even the personal pronoun does not minimize that in any way. They understood it to be the prayers of the community. Yeah. I would just reinforce that even more strongly, that it's hard to read it individualistically because they did not think in those terms. Not as family members, nor as a community of faith.
And the church supplants this consciousness of the idea of the community of God.
It's one of the weaknesses of the modern church, actually, that we would think in those terms. Yeah, it's not the way they would have thought. David himself, his expressions of wonder about having to run from the enemies, is not even so much about his own personal safety. It's that God's promises rest on his personal safety. And those are promises to the people. It's to Israel and to Israel's well-being. So he's seeing himself in that light. Now, let's note this feature. Someone brought it up. I think Frank brought up the notion of rock and castle. Notice the imagery that is brought up here. And it might be helpful to wonder what he might mean by the term rock. I mean, when we think rock, what do we think of?
Enduring power.
Something that's strong and powerful. We also tend to think of something we can put in our hand and throw. Not the rock that they had in mind. Has anyone been to a place like Masada in Israel?
And the Dome of the Rock.
Okay, so that's the rock. We're talking about what essentially is a rock mount on which you could build something. It would be a fortress because you would shelter yourself up there and your enemy had no good approach to you, therefore you could hold them off, at least for a period of time. So think big rock, like really big rock that you can't pick up and handle. And there are gods like that, like a castle that keeps me safe, like a crag, a stronghold, a place cut into rock where you can hide and shelter yourself. This imagery runs throughout the Psalter. Very rich imagery that is used. And of course they would use this. They're trying to talk about God, and it's hard to just come up with an image that says everything. So they'll latch on to those things that are associated with the kind of emotion or situation that they're in. In this case, it's protection that they need. So yes, we'll express it by saying refuge. What kind of refuge? Well, a big, huge rock or a castle or a crag or a stronghold, something like that.
Yeah. So the communal political element runs throughout.
Yeah, well, yes.
I mean, they're worried about their enemies.
They are. They are situated. Their context is that they're always in opposition to someone, right? I mean, they've established a land by running people out, so those people obviously are trying to get back in. And then they have the internal enemies. So you have David's Psalms where at least a later editor has come in to note a little heading that says it's when he was on the run from his son. So external and internal foes. So these poems are conditioned by their situatedness in such a context. Anything else about this text?
Yeah, but then they're hopeful and sustained.
That's exactly
so
right. You are my hope, my confidence since I was young. I've been sustained by you ever since I was born. From my mother's womb you've been my strength. My praise shall be always of you. And this last little line, you recall when we looked at the first week, we looked at the ending of the books. Remember the five books, and the first four end with a little text of praise every time. And you'll see this on some individual psalms. And then the end of the Psalter, of course, ends with a set of grand psalms of praise. And you'll see this on some of these where you'll get to the end of a section. And this is just the end of a section of this psalm. And that tag is thrown in there. Notice, couplets. And then what? a couplet with an additional line, and that line is, "My praise shall be always of you." That's a normal feature of these texts, to add that one line in that's a remembrance of the fact that Yahweh is to be praised. So I drew that one out since we were actually using it in the liturgy, and we recited it together, which would be one way of doing this. Of course, a typical way of doing it is to do what with this text? To sing it, for it to be recited in some way. I think it was last week I noted there are some Hebrew scholars who believe, that is, scholars of Hebrew, who believe some of the markings in the Hebrew language, because at the time this was done, the Hebrew, as far as we know, it had no markings. There were no vowels, no markings. And they came a bit later. And there are a couple of prominent scholars who believe they were really added for recitation purposes, because the text would have always been recited in some way. That is, chanted or sung. Which allows that sense of that meditation, the practice of meditation that we saw in Psalm 1. So there's the wicked person, remember, and then there's the person whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on that law he meditates, mulls over, recites over and over, day and night, the Torah of the Lord, the law of the Lord. Psalm 90 is one of the longer psalms. It begins book 4. The superscription I don't have on here, it says, "Of Moses, a man of God." And so this is attached to Moses, and in fact some of the lines from it are familiar to some texts in the Torah and some texts that are in the Jewish Apocrypha, so text outside of their canon. The Book of Jubilees, there are some lines taken from that. So this is associated with the prophet Moses. And let's just do a reading of this. And it's 3 slides, so we'll scan through and then see what we see. "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn us back to dust and say, 'Turn back, you mortals.' For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night. You sweep them away. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. For we are consumed by your anger. By your wrath we are overwhelmed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days pass away under your wrath. Our years come to an end like a sigh. The days of our life are 70 years, or perhaps 80 if we are strong. Even then, their span is only toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger, your wrath that is great as the fear that is due you? So teach us to count our days, that we may gain a wise heart. Turn, O Lord, how long? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, so that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad as many days as you have afflicted us, and as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be manifest to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and prosper us the work of our hands. O prosper the work of our hands." Let's look at this one backward.
Yeah.
So where do we end up? You have the supplication, the main supplication of the text, is actually in this third stanza, which is asking Yahweh to help us number our days. And the purpose of that is so that we are wise about how we live. Because the psalm has been about the fact that life is ephemeral. I mean, you have the notion that there's a reference once again to Genesis. we're returned back to dust. So from dust we came. I mean, we know that, right, from the funeral liturgy. From dust we came, and to dust we shall return. We will say that again soon at Lent, right? So you have that notion embedded in here that we're dusty mortals, and we don't live long. And the request is for Yahweh to help us to understand that life is fleeting, and therefore we should be wise about how we use our days. And then there's the question, we just noted that this happens, turn, O Lord, how long, that how long is the, how long will it be till you turn and have compassion on your servants? Because the sense of the psalmist here is that Yahweh has turned the back. This is a term that shows up early in the Psalter, shuv, and it is used both of God and of us. And it is God speaking to the people, turn back around to me, and I'll turn back to you. The notion is that the two parties have turned their backs on one another. They're going in separate ways. And the lament of the psalmist is that God's back is turned, and how long is that going to happen? Because as long as God is turned away from us, we're in trouble. This you'll also see the language, it was in Psalm 24, of God being, we see it as that God is present to us, and literally what the text says is God's face is to us. This is kind of a confounding bit of language, because when we think of Moses and God's face, what do we think of? If Moses sees God's face, what happens? He dies. And yet, Moses wants to be as close to seeing God's face as possible because he wants God to be present with the people. Now, this whole thing of him getting the tablets and God's glory being present among the people and then there being a tabernacle is all about them knowing Yahweh is present with them. So they build a tent that has this place for worship, and God is supposed to dwell in this one spot, but not just anybody can go in there, right? Can't just wander in and say hey to God. In fact, the going in happens once a year, drawn by lots, ritual purification of the priest, who has a robe with little bells on it so you can know that when he goes back there he's still moving. And just as a safety net, they tie a rope to the leg, because if he goes down, nobody's going in after him, because it's a dangerous thing to see the face of God, right? Well, this is them asking for God to turn his face back to them, because they want God's presence. Because if God is turned away from them, then they have no hope. So turn, O Lord. How long? How long will you be turned away from us? So have compassion on your servants, because this is what happens when God's face is turned to the people. They're satisfied by God's, there's our term again, kesed, God's covenant loyalty or covenant love. Bring satisfaction so that you can rejoice and be glad all our days. Look at this next line. Make us glad as many days as you have afflicted us and as many days as we have seen evil. At the very least, could we have a 50-50 on this? We've had plenty of trouble. Could we have some good days to kind of balance that out? What about the ending? It's more supplication. They want God's work to be manifest in them and his power to be in and among them, and then for God's favor to be on them so the work of their hands will prosper. There's a kind of let's be in this together. Now let's work our way back in the text. We may come back to the ending. Let's see if I can do this. Let's start from the beginning now. What do we observe at the beginning of this text? Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. It's gone quiet all of a sudden.
Well, it's back to Genesis again.
Yeah, we keep seeing Genesis, don't we? I did not carefully select psalm texts so that you could see texts that refer back to the Torah. They just do it all the time. And Genesis is a prime place to go back to. And it's this notion, again, that Yahweh has made everything, Yahweh is sovereign over everything, it's the Lord's. We saw this in Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof.
Is it not hard to fail to go back to the Torah?
I guess you could ignore it, but in their habits of...
You have to ignore it.
Yeah, I mean, in their habits of life, it was ever present, right? So in this case, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth of the world, that's reading off of Genesis. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So this is the notion that God predates anything that's created. God is not of the created order, and God is eternal. And it's that God who has been Israel's dwelling place in all generations. We're back to a place of refuge. It's the place we live. God is the place we live. And then we have our little dusty section. You turn us back to dust and say, turn back, you mortals. There's our notion of Yahweh saying to the people, turn back to me, or else. There's an or else implied in there. So what's to be made of this next part of the stanza? I mean, we've been reminded that we're mortals.
Well, this time is not our time.
That there's a different accounting of time here. What seems like a really long time to us is like yesterday. It's like the day before to God. Or, to emphasize it even more, like a watch in the night. A watch in the night would be a few hours. So to God, 1,000 years is like yesterday, or even just a few hours. And what is time like? What are our days like? Yeah, they can be just swept away. It's like I thought it was real, but it wasn't real. Or, if that's not earthy enough for you, it's like the green grass that grows up in the morning and it looks all rich and all of that with the morning sun, and then by evening, things begin to fade. Things come, things go. Very much getting us to think about the ebb and flow of life and the fact that we're dusty mortals. So I put you in your happy place? Charles?
I was just going to say, I think one of the themes here is that it's only in the intersection of time and eternity that time has meaning. Otherwise, it's just perpetual perishing.
Yeah.
The time of modern physical cosmology. Yeah. Purposeless passage.
No to what end, right? Yeah. This definitely cues you that there is an end to things and a meaningful end. Because at the end is God. He's from everlasting to everlasting. It's the one thing that endures. The one that endures. So we go back to, there's a four here, so let's see what that's for. So for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night. You sweep them away, they're like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. So there, instead of being dust, we're grass. Seems a little bit better. For we are consumed by your anger, by your wrath we are overwhelmed. This is where we start fidgeting in our seats. This is also where in the lectionary sometimes, depending on which cycle it's through, part of this stanza is dropped out. We're not so big on wrath. We like compassion, steadfast love. Those all sound good. Anger, wrath, not so much.
What did those terms mean?
Charles is laughing about it.
I mean what they say.
Sue thinks they mean what they say.
I'm not sure they do too.
So what do you think? Lots of smiles around the room.
Is it in the preceding verses, you could, I don't know if it's correct or not, but you could almost look at that as the implication is that we're kind of pretty insignificant in the whole scheme of things. And then you step into this notion of, as we think of those terms, mm-hmm. anger and wrath, this seems like a disconnect. Or is it a statement that God's not real happy about the way things have turned out?
So how do we use these terms? Just what's our own notion of anger and wrath? What do we think?
Moral.
What?
You think of something moral? There's been an injustice and there's a response to it?
But I think that's why anger is connected to it, because anger is the fundamental moral emotion, I think. But when you look at the kind of work that Otto has done, then you realize that this notion of wrath, it's what he calls a numinous term. It refers to something that cannot ultimately be explained, even in moral terms. And that's why it can be used in passages, for example, that go that also include steadfast love. How do you make sense out of that?
Putting together a wrath and
steadfast. You're all the time having to bring people to account.
Yeah.
So it's mystery. It's a mysterious word.
Does it have reference to history, like the flood?
The notion of God's anger, it certainly does. I mean, if we're going to draw the connections to the Torah, then this is one place you would go. You would think that God's dissatisfaction in even grief over what had happened with the world caused him to act in anger in a monumental fashion. Yeah. And there are plenty of psalm texts that go back to the waters. We had one last week that take you back to the notion of these powerful waters. But what else Charles mentioned this is a moral term. I mean, we all experience anger, right?
But only in part, a moral term. It's much more.
Yeah, I'd say it is more, but we experience it, and it could be something like somebody cuts us off in traffic or takes our parking place. And let's admit it, right?
Yeah.
All right, so that happens. Or it could be something over which we experience moral outrage, that a genuine injustice has been done. That could be something like somebody harmed our child or grandchild. And trust me, you get angry. I mean, admit it, don't you? Or something like ISIS. I draw the lines. We experience anger over those kinds of injustices. It is a very natural emotion. Imagine if we didn't have it. If we didn't have that emotion, would we be moral agents?
Right. Well, you just need someone to step on your toe.
So this is where when Sue says it means what it means, in some sense, that's absolutely right. I think we tend to want to say God can't be like that. But what's happening here, what the Torah teaches us is actually we're like Yahweh. That whatever that thing is, in its best sense, we're like that. Now, we know that our anger actually operates in other ways, right? We know that. It offers, it acts in selfish, kind of petulant ways. We're not affirming that. Well, we affirm that it happens. We're not complimenting that in any way. That's not a good. Here, they're saying they're consumed by the anger of Yahweh, that this is actually something that comes from God as far as they can see it. It's their way of describing how they see God working, is that God is angry. Later on, I mean, Jewish and Christian theologians will argue over whether or not God actually experiences emotion. Just set that aside. They are, by the way they see God working, they are attributing something like anger and wrath to God. They have good reason to do this because they see that things are, they're being judged in some way.
It's it's rightful unto, right?
That's, I think that's certainly how they would see it, although they would like it to end. Yeah.
Yeah, but if the absence of the wrath is amoral, I mean, if there's never any indignation over the lack of righteousness, you can't see the face of God.
I think this is exactly at the heart of these texts, that's what has to be in order for God to be turned back to us and for us to be turned back to God. And in part, I think what's happening with the, for we are consumed by your anger, by your wrath, we are overwhelmed, you have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. It is an acknowledgement and an admission of these things. I think it's why in the liturgy on most Sundays you do what? Before you
confess.
Yeah, you confess before you offer peace to one another. It's that notion. It's kind of that root notion that there are things that are not the way they're supposed to be, and sometimes they're not supposed to be that way. They're the way they are because we made them that way. It's actually our fault.
Going back to what Lee said, to me, I see this is the mindset of the Jewish people, and this is before Jesus. So when Jesus comes, so life without Jesus would be, yeah, there'd be anger, there'd be wrath, there'd be, you know, but Jesus comes, that's where he was not accepted by the Jewish people, because he said, whoa, I'm changing everything. So there's no more anger, there's no more wrath. Because of me, your inequities are set aside.
I'd say yes and no. In one sense, I think what made some of them so angry was particularly that he said, God's angry at you. And yes, they can be set aside if you will. And notice, when he announces the kingdom, what does he tell everyone to do? He uses the R word, to repent. Which is, it is. It is exactly the same concept. In fact, when you get to the Greek translation of the Jewish Bible, you'll find that shuv can be replaced by the term that's used for repent. So it's actually the same idea that's being used. I'd actually see there's a lot of continuity between what he's doing and what they're doing. The problem is you have some of these religious leaders who don't want to admit that they have any iniquities. Because in the end, it's the self-righteousness that keeps you kind of in the brew of God's anger and wrath, right? It's the unwillingness to admit our own culpability.
Wouldn't you expect, if you recognize this idea of being, we are consumed by God's anger, by God's wrath, wouldn't it follow that there should be some mentioning then about judgment? Is there judgment?
Well, it may be, Lee, that what happens is absent throwing out terms like judgment or what we would call hell, which is not really a concept they're using here. They're saying our lives come to an end. I wonder if that's it, if that's what you're looking for. It's that things come to an end, and it may not be a good end, because life is full of toil and trouble. Things are not like we want them to be. They're soon gone. And we fly away, and yes, that's where that gospel song came from. It came from Psalm 90, from this little phrase right here. I'll fly away. Yeah. Inspired by Psalm 90. But think about that song, those of you that know it. Just a few more weary days, and then I'll fly away. It's this. It's all the toil and trouble, and how is it going to be, how am I going to be relieved of it? I'll fly away to heaven. I'm not sure it's exactly the right way to frame that theologically, but you get the sentiment, which is, I'll escape all of this one day, and I'll be in my happy place. Yeah.
Well, don't you think the dominant view, though, in the ancient Hebrew world was that the end is Sheol? And that's hardly heaven. I mean,
it's the place of the dead.
Obliteration of life.
Yeah. For some, yeah, major concept that this is the place of the dead and what's to come.
Nothing.
Yeah. Jesus will obviously offer a different view of things, but Isaiah would offer a different view of things. So it's not a monolithic view in the Hebrew scriptures. Yeah, I mean, there you have a very different vision of what's to come. And when you read the book of Revelation, Lee, it's just quoting a lot of those texts about what's to come. So now we get to the final stanza, which we began with. So we'll wrap this up. So in light of all of that, the kind of anxiety you get from days are full of toil and trouble, and I don't know how all of this is going to end, and we know not only are we suffering, but God's anger and wrath is upon us, and we would like relief. So the prayer is, so teach us to number our days, that we may gain a wise heart. And turn, Yahweh, turn back to us. How long will it be till you come back to us and have compassion and satisfy us and make us glad and manifest your work to us and put your favor on us so the work of our hands can prosper? That's the prayer that happens. Note the response that's there. It isn't to say, we'd like for you to come fix everything so we can relax. It's, would you turn back to us so we can find satisfaction and do meaningful work with our hands? That's the prayer, actually. That God's favor is for us to be able to do good with what's given to us, which is very much a return to the Torah. That's kind of the prospect of the garden, isn't it? Where Adam and his people are in the place God made where they could be blessed and work the land and do what's to be done and enjoy the presence of Yahweh and others. These prayers kind of take you back to Eden, which Revelation does too. Like, it takes you back to that beginning in a place of delight. It's probably a good place to land on this. So, thus the reading of the prayers of the people that we know as the Psalms. I hope this has been of help to you.
So, David, is this the last? We don't have another?
This is it.
Round of applause.